The E-Commerce Fuel Podcast is brought to you by One-Click Upsell by Zipify Apps. You probably know there's three ways to make more money from your store. You can get more traffic, you can increase the size of the orders you get, or you can increase the number of people that convert on your site. You're probably spending time on traffic, almost certainly. You may have spent time with conversion rate optimization, but when's the last time, honestly, you tried to increase that cart size? Well, One-Click Upsell makes it incredibly easy to offer powerful targeted upsells to your customers. They've generated over $150 million in additional revenue for store owners, just like you. And over 16% of people who get offered an upsell actually take you up on it. It's really powerful. Their entire system is built into Shopify's native checkout, so it's rock solid and secure. And it's built by Ezra Firestone and his team. Ezra, you may know, good friend of mine. He's been in the e-commerce game for a long time. He uses this on his own eight-figure stores. He's in the trenches and he knows it works. So if you want to actually start working on a third of your business that you've been neglecting, increasing that cart size, check them out today at ecommercefuel.com/upsell. The E-Commerce Fuel Podcast is sponsored by Klaviyo. If you're working around the clock to build your e-commerce business, you need an e-commerce specific marketing platform that works just as hard as you do. That means you need Klaviyo. With Klaviyo, you'll delight customers and drive revenue at the same time personalized email and SMS marketing campaigns that you can design and send in minutes without an IT degree. It's by far the most popular email marketing tool in our private community of 7- and 8-figure e-commerce store owners because it's got incredibly advanced and powerful segmentation features that help you make more money. To get started for free and to learn more, check them out at klaviyo.com/ECF. That's klaviyo.com/ECF. Hey, it's Andrew here, and welcome to the E-Commerce Fuel Podcast, a show dedicated to helping 7-figure-plus e-commerce brands build incredible businesses and amazing lives. And today on the show, I'm joined by Caressa DeGranger, who is the owner of Mathmos.com. You may recognize the company more as the original creator and inventor of the Lava Lamp. And she joined recently the E-Commerce Fuel private community, and I saw her, saw the brand and her background and her story, and I thought, oh, I have to have her on the show to talk about, yeah, just her story and business and get to know her better. And she did not disappoint. We cover a lot of stuff, of course, how she purchased this kind of iconic classic brand in a back of the napkin deal, kind of in some interesting circumstances, which you'll find out in the show. What happened when people found out their patent had expired, what that did to the business, how they pivoted. We talk about wholesale a lot. They've really moved away from wholesale. I think that's going to be something that becomes more common in the future. We talked about how she was able to make that transition well without alienating her suppliers in the short run and killing profits in the long run. And we also talk about international operations. She ships out of Britain, makes everything in England. We talk about Brexit, how that's impacted the business, the technical challenges from a shopping cart perspective of selling internationally, and a bunch more. So enjoyed her tremendously. I think you will as well. And let's go ahead and get right into it. Welcome to the show. So good to have you.
Great to be here. Thanks for asking me.
Yeah, of course. And I thought we could start with the story of how you purchased Mathmos. It's such a cool story. Can you talk about how that came about?
Yeah, well, I was dealing in 60s and 70s furniture and lighting, and I came across a lava lamp in a market in an old box and rung the number on the box, and the business was still going, and it ended up being in the town I was born in. So I ended up going there and buying lamps and destroying the boxes so none of the other dealers could get hold of their lamps and selling them in the market. And they were a runaway hit on the market. Another dealer asked to sort of start a shop with me. I was like, well, lava lamps, you know, they're the commercial option. Why don't we try and make them? So we tried to make them, which is, you know, not easy at all. So, yeah, so then we wrote to the company who I was buying the lamps from. And the owner, the inventor of the lava lamp, said, Edward Craven Walker, he invited us down to his nudist camp.
Sorry, to his nudist camp, the creator of the lava lamp who lived on a nudist colony?
Well, he owned a nudist camp. That's right. He also made underwater nudist films. So, yeah, he's quite an eccentric.
This is a rich history I did not know existed.
Yeah. So we had this kind of surreal meeting in a nudist camp, and he was looking for a solution really for his business that was tiny and losing money, and he was in his 70s. So he said, look, you know, you come and run it, you buy the stock and the bits of componentry he had in a polytunnel in his garden, and the bits of machinery such as they were, you buy them, and then when you bought them, you can have the company. That was pretty much what happened.
So when you say he had a tiny company that was losing money, so this was when, I mean, this is when lava lamps were fairly popular though, right? Or at least after it, or had it kind of spiked and it was on the way down and they had kind of like the popularity had ebbed, or how is
it?
Well,
I mean, they were very popular in the 60s and 70s, and then by the 80s, they'd really gone out of fashion. So when I was selling them on the market, sort of in the late 80s, you couldn't really buy them anywhere. So, yeah, no, they were tiny at that point. So this was in 1989, such a long time ago, yeah.
Okay, interesting. And so I was reading somewhere, kind of in prepping for this, that you did kind of a no lawyer napkin deal, I believe. Like, it sounded like the original founder hated lawyers. You guys just had a back of the napkin agreement. And as someone who's come off a couple either closed or pending investment deals I've been working on, where even my lawyer is fantastic, but just like the raw amount of legalese that sometimes gets put into things seemingly, you know, seems unnecessary at some point, you know, this stuck with me. So how did that work out? Like, did that work out pretty well? The no lawyer napkin deal, or did that come back to bite you?
It didn't, but it made me really nervous. I mean, I hated it. I was always trying to get him to do a proper agreement. I mean, apart from anything, it seemed too good to be true. Yeah, no, I mean, he honored everything on it amazingly. So yeah, but I wouldn't do it again if I could avoid it.
It worked out, but would not recommend.
Yeah.
Got it. So late 80s, you buy. What made you want to buy it? I mean, because obviously it's one thing to find these and resell them and kind of as a collectible piece or kind of a antiques, things like that, which it sounds like you were maybe kind of doing. It's another thing to go out and buy the entire stock and manufacturing capabilities of a company that's kind of well past its, you know, its day in the, having its day in the sun. So what made you think this was a good idea? Obviously, it's worked out brilliantly well, but I kind of in the mindset, like, what made you jump in and do it?
Well, because I'd been selling them on the markets for a few years, and I mean, it was quite amazing. They were just the best seller on the market, you know, so all the other dealers were trying to find out where I got them. And it was just, you know, they were just ludicrously easy to sell. So obviously, yeah, in hindsight, it was a bonkers thing to do. We knew absolutely nothing.
You had the marketing channels for it. It sounds like the owner was able to manufacture them, but wasn't able to distribute or market them that well. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's fair. So we had to learn how to make them. But the selling, you know, I mean, we had to find new channels, obviously, and open shops and things. But the selling, you know, wasn't as hard as the manufacture.
What was the, I was going to ask which one's harder, but you kind of answered it. What was that learning curve like going from someone who sourced lava lamps, sold them to all of a sudden, oh, wow, now I own a manufacturing business overnight? What was the most challenging part of that, of, you know, climbing that learning curve?
It was, you know, sorting out, David Mully was my business partner at the time. And I wanted to do everything. I wanted to drive the forklift. I wanted to go to the metal spinners. You know, I wanted to do everything. And so did he. So we kind of, you know, sorting out who was going to end up being, you know, the best person to do what was, you know, the first thing. And just, you know, so that we could, you know, try and learn as quickly as possible. So, you know, it was just a massive learning curve. We made so many mistakes, but it was really great fun.
What was the biggest mistake you made during those first early years?
Oh, God, trademark mistakes. I don't know. I mean, I think we did quite well. I mean, we took it, you know, it grew sort of doubled in size every year for a decade. So, which was great. But, you know, and when that's small, it's not that hard. It's when it gets bigger, it's a little harder. No, it was great.
So the 90s, it sounded like you bought in late 80s. The 90s, it sounded like, were really strong, obviously economically, but for your business as well. Was that just kind of riding the general economic wave? Was it the beginning of e-commerce? Was it they kind of came back into popularity during the 90s?
It was just fashion. They just, people hadn't seen them for a while. They fitted right into the look of the time. And they just kind of hit a nerve and people wanted them. So it was fashion. There was really no e-commerce to speak of. So yeah, it was fashion. And we, you know, I really tried to manage that fashion as well as possible, you know, being really selective about the retailers, you know, really trying to, you know, position them properly so that it would last as long as possible.
And something I'm excited to hear about that I don't think I've ever chatted with anyone else on the show about it is you had, I believe you had a patent on the product, or at least you acquired one with the business sale, which may lead to why you were a little nervous about the back of the napkin deal. I'm starting to see this more. But your patent expired, and then people, a couple of things that sounded like it expired and people didn't know for a while, but then people found out, and I'm guessing, correct me if I'm wrong, but you probably had a lot more, you know, people flooding the market. You had much more competition after you didn't have exclusive rights to it. Talk about that period a little bit. What was that like, and how did that impact the business?
Yeah, well, in fact, we never had a patent that was, you know, the patents last 20 years, and it was long gone by the time I pitched up. But we printed all the numbers on the boxes, which you're not allowed to do, which I didn't. So I didn't know that at the time, but yeah, it's illegal, but we did. And so people didn't realize that we didn't have a patent at all. And I think, you know, because we were quite young and we didn't, you know, I don't think people realized that, you know, that they were selling really for quite a long time. And then, you know, then the penny dropped and the copies came in a vengeance. So that was very hard. I mean, you know, it was going to happen and we were kind of waiting for it to happen. I mean, it took a while, but when it happened, it was hard. Yeah.
Yeah. How did you guys get through that time? Did you pivot? Did you just kind of get lean? Was it temporary? And obviously you guys have a you know, thriving business today. How did you get through the other side of that?
Well, you know, we did all of those things. I mean, David left when the copies started to come, because we knew it was going to be really hard. And I was, you know, I was itching to get my hands on the whole thing, really. I wanted to expand the range. I wanted to develop lots of new products. I wanted to do this, that, and the other. So we did pivot. I kind of thought it would happen as it did in the 80s, where lava lamps disappeared. But that didn't happen. So I, you know, mistakenly, really, I diversified. You know, I spent a good 15 years actually diversifying into loads of different products. So we did, and lots of them I'm really proud of. We did some great lighting products for our current customers. You know, every one you're hoping is the next big hit, the next lava lamp. And it took me quite a long time to realize that the next lava lamp was the lava lamp.
hard to be a classic.
Yeah. So, and we did get leaner, you know, it was tough.
So I'd love to, one of the things I was especially interested to talk to you about was wholesale, because it seems like you have moved away from wholesale. How long did you sell wholesale? How long did you sell wholesale before you decided to start tapering off wholesale and just focusing D2C?
It sort of came together with refocusing the business back into what no one can really take away from us, which is we invented lava lamps and we made the best quality ones and the original thing. And so that, you know, that change really doesn't work if you're wholesaling. And it works brilliantly online because you can tell your story. You can communicate to people why they should pay more, you know, what they're buying. And that's very hard to do in a shop. When you're, you know, stocked alongside lots of copies and you can't tell your story. So they went together. So, you know, in the 90s, we were, you know, 99% wholesale. And then, you know, the e-commerce side built gradually. And then it became more and more obvious that was going to be the better route, the more profitable route, the more exciting route as well. And something new as well for me. You know, I've been doing the same business for a long time and I know how to do wholesale back to front, and it was exciting to move into e-commerce. And there's so many ways that it makes much more sense for my business than wholesale.
Yeah. What percent do you do wholesale at all anymore? Is it 100% just straight to customer?
Yeah, we do a bit. We do a few sectors that have their own kind of wholesale world. And we have some, you know, some shops that we enjoy supplying, and we'll do it kind of reactively, but it's pretty small now. Although, weirdly, they are coming again. It seems to be growing again. I don't know why.
I want to get into it in just a minute, how you kind of prune your wholesale channels back without, you know, offending massive swaths of your retailers and or, you know, causing problems. But how do you, today, the wholesalers that you have, How do you cherry pick the best wholesalers? What are you looking for? Is it payment terms? Is it just how they're going to, you know, got commitment to showcasing your product in a really a great way at retail? How do you pick the few wholesalers that you focus on for the 80-20 results?
So we would only deal with somebody who's reaching people we can't reach. So we're not interested in reaching people who are going to advertise on Google, you know, against us to drive customers. We want them. We want people who have a great retail outlet, you know, physical retail outlet, very rare, or have some sort of route to market that, you know, that isn't shared with us. That would be it, really.
And how do you... So when you decided to start pruning your wholesale back, how do you go about that? Because it's, you know, for a couple of things, like one, the reputation in the industry, if you just cut some wholesalers off immediately, others could get worried. You might have, you know, AP issues you have to think about if they haven't paid you. But also probably even the hardest one is just thinking about sales. I mean, you mentioned 99% of your sales were coming from wholesale, and today that's obviously much less, but there's got to be something that you kind of, was it kind of a long-term plan that you unrolled over years and years? I'm guessing it had to be.
Yeah, I'm afraid it was. I'm sure that other people could do it in a braver way than I wanted to. But yeah, it took years, in fact. You know, we're unusual in that we have classic product with, you know, quite a tight range, and, you know, we don't really discount. So, you know, we had to really protect our product. So we couldn't really afford to kind of cut people off and have them dump product online. You know, so it was a gradual thing.
When you say cut people off and have them dump product online, what would cause a wholesaler, if you did say, hey, sorry, we're not selling to you anymore, to really just blow through their inventory at super low prices? Was it because they said, oh, hey, well, there's no existing relationship in the future, so we'll just discount to get the sales quickly and move them? Is that kind of,
yeah.
Why would, yeah.
Yeah, you just clear down your stock, I think. And that's what I'd do, probably.
Yeah. What did you try an approach, you know, for some people who have struggled with wholesale, I know they've had, you know, people have thought about, well, hey, well, we only do wholesale, but we don't offer terms. You have to pay credit card, for example. Or, yeah, we do wholesale, but, you know, instead of, we used to offer 50%, now we're offering 35 or 40% off. Did you try taking a kind of an approach to just saying, hey, here's the part about wholesales, the parts about wholesale we absolutely hate, let's get rid of those and still try to keep those, you know, those people that are willing to play by our rules?
Yeah, we did a bit. We certainly narrowed our margins for wholesale, and that shed a few people. And we did that selectively with different kind of sectors, different routes to market. So ones we, you know, wanted to keep more, had a better terms and so forth. So we did do that. And I think there are quicker ways of doing it. I mean, I think, you know, the staff side was the hardest, because it's hard when you've got a sales target to say no to a large order and yes to lots of little ones, and learning. I didn't, you know, having had to restructure after we got copied, I was really keen not to have to do that again as much as possible. So I really wanted to sort of take everybody with us on this new e-commerce journey, really, rather than, you know, let people go and hire new people.
Yeah, that surprised me too. When I was kind of prepping for this, your thoughts about the staff being the hardest part, which makes sense in, you know, when you describe it, but how did you have to set up any new incentive structures, or did you have to, apart from just sitting people down and saying, hey, here's the deal. If you, you know, want to have a job at this company in 5 years, here's how we need to do things. Was that enough, or did you have to try to change incentive structures, or how did you get the team on board with saying no to the, you know, the $10,000 wholesale order, which is tough?
Yeah, I mean, we are, it's a sort of all of those things, you know, trying to take everybody with us, giving more incentive for e-commerce sales, bigger bonuses connected to those, and having a whole load of rules about who you could and couldn't accept orders from. And really trying to win hearts and minds on that e-commerce journey. So, yeah, I mean, I think, it, you know, we got there without, you know, moving into loss and without. So, you know, it was a journey, but, it, you know, and it's a very, very old company. So I think, you know, I think we probably took longer than you would have to over it. And I think if you had a lot of new product coming out the whole time, it would be a much easier transition. Whereas if you've got classic product that doesn't change very much, it's much harder.
Do you think wholesale, and obviously you have some facets to your business that made wholesale not a great fit for you, but I think in general, I think a lot of the trends that are powering commerce online and retail online are similar. It's getting, you can't, it's really hard to sell other people's stuff online. You have to have your own brand or something. And granted, you know, quality and uniqueness wins. So I think increasingly merchants that are going to do well online are going to have products that are more similar to yours, maybe not with the cachet that the original Lava Lamp does, but some of the similar attributes. Do you think wholesale in general is going to be as popular of a channel a decade from now? Or do you think we're going to see this erosion of wholesale continue across the board for merchants?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, in general, the people in the middle are falling away, aren't they? And retailers, you know, who stock other people's brands are people in the middle. But then marketplaces are getting bigger. I mean, maybe, you know, if retailers are going to survive, they're going to have to become sort of more marketplaces, aren't they? It's hard to imagine how some of these big department stores and so forth can survive in the future, apart from sort of renting space as a showroom, a physical showroom. Yeah, wholesale is, you know, COVID, of course, has accelerated all of that massively. Certainly, you know, London is empty of retailers. And the big retailers who you used to dream of supplying, I mean, you wouldn't touch them with a barge pole now.
Hey, it's Andrew here with a quick aside. If you're listening to this episode and enjoying it, then I've got to tell you about our private community for 7- and 8-figure e-commerce brands. The secret sauce, as the name implies, is that everyone inside, we vet everyone to make sure they have real-world experience running an e-commerce brand and struggle with the same kind of things that you do if that's the position you're in. And why is that important? Well, it means you get fast, on-point answers to your most important questions. So if you've got somebody that HR issue and you're worried about letting someone go, but you're worried about a lawsuit or you're trying to figure out the best ERP to implement or maybe you're trying to understand marketing techniques, you can post a message to our form and get answers within hours, sometimes minutes, from experts who know this stuff. You get to plug into an amazing network of e-commerce entrepreneurs worldwide across the United States and the globe that you can connect with when you're traveling for meetups and get invites to member-only events like ECF Live. And then finally, you can avoid costly hiring and software mistakes by tapping into our review directory of over 10,000 reviews for agencies and e-commerce software tools. I mean, it's really hard to find unbiased reviews online right now. So often they're either paid for or they're affiliate links. All of our reviews are completely unbiased. So when you go down the road of hiring a new ad agency or looking for that new, you know, ERP software, you have a lot more confidence that you're not going to be wasting the next 3 or 4 months of your life on an expensive project. So if that sounds interesting to you, come join us. You can learn more and apply ecommercefuel.com, and we'd love to have you inside. All right, let's get back to the discussion. Speaking of London, I'd love to hear just a little bit about kind of international and operating out of England. And Brexit is a good place to start. How is Brexit playing out for your company? Because like, what are the effects on the ground? Because I believe it became effective, I'm not positive about this, but was it January 1 of this year?
Yeah, that's right. So we were treated to COVID and Brexit simultaneously, which is great. Well, yeah, I mean, I'm no fan of Brexit, but we're waiting with bated breath to see if there are any positive things to come out of it. At the moment, it's just a load of negatives, really. We've been preparing for it for years. So a lot, you know, more than half of our sales into continental Europe. So we had to really prepare for any friction there. So it's been fine. We've traded throughout. Loads and loads of e-commerce companies in Britain are still not trading into continental Europe. It's got much more bureaucratic, much more expensive. So it's, you know, it has changed things completely, really.
Yeah, if you would talk a little bit more about that. And this is for, you know, anyone selling, you know, out of England to Europe, or especially Europe, you're going to know this. But for Americans and folks across the world who have no idea, but are just, you know, curious about it, what is it you said you've been preparing for? What changed for you? So obviously, was it a tariff issue? Did shipping get more expensive? Did you have some kind of issues with websites? Like what, pre and post Brexit, what got more difficult in terms of selling and fulfilling an order for you to someone in, let's say, you know, France or Spain or Greece?
Okay, so there's just loads of things. So you need VAT, much more complicated. You need to have an authorized representative in every single individual country in Europe where you're above a certain level. And then you have to file for VAT in that country as well. You need importers of record. You need to have, there are tariff issues if you're not making in Britain or making in Europe. There is much, much more customs bureaucracy. carriage is much more expensive. It's much slower. So you used to be able to sell, you know, I used to be able to send a lamp to Germany from Poole for £6. There is no way I could do that now. You can't send individual parcels. You have to really have a fulfillment center in Europe. And it takes, you know, weeks to book in a slot. You know, it's introduced a world of pain. But, you know, there are ways around it. It does make Great Britain separate to the rest of Europe. And then there's divergence coming on product compliance. So, you know, lots of things to negotiate.
You mentioned you need a fulfillment center and you know, the shipping gets more expensive. Do you have multiple fulfillment centers all across Europe? You know, maybe in Germany, Spain, you know, your top locations to be able to do that, or are you just eating the additional shipping and import and costs?
No, so we have a fulfillment center, not our own, but you know, somebody else's fulfillment center in Germany, and they fulfill all of the EU orders from there. So that works really well. Yeah, and we put those in years ago, so we've bedded them in and they work really well. So that's fine. So we just got to get our stock out in quantity to there, and then it goes out from there, and that's fine. So, you know, if you were an American company, you'd need to have a fulfillment center in the EU on the continent and in Britain now, I think. And then we also would have Amazon Prime in, you know, all the Amazons of Europe as well.
Has it changed? You know, I think you mentioned Europe makes up about 50% of your sales earlier. Has that changed how you're focusing on growing your brand? Like, is it, I could see one or two situations. You say, this is just the new normal. We got to deal with it. Europe's a huge market and we're going to suck it up and make it work. Or do you start looking at other markets that are maybe easier to sell into? Has it changed how you're thinking about growing your business and where you're thinking about expanding in the future, or not necessarily?
No, not really. I mean, we've paid our dues. We've done the work. Europe's on our doorstep. It's our biggest market. So no, but yeah, of course we want to look outside of Europe in the future as well. You know, in a way it's a good thing because, you know, because there are barriers to sail into Europe and, you know, it puts people off doing the work.
You also mentioned, or you didn't mention, but earlier I saw that you have a customer service rep in Italy, or you hired one. Was that, what's your approach to customer service selling into Europe? Do you have multiple reps in multiple languages, or was that just a unique case for a certain reason? Like, how do you, or is English kind of fairly commonly used? Well, obviously commonly used throughout Europe, but from a customer service standpoint, how do you try to balance the expense of lots of different customer service languages versus convenience? And how do you think about that?
Well, I think that for us, our biggest markets, we have local nationals from the country in our factory dealing with customer service. So even in Holland or Germany, where most people speak English, they prefer to speak their local language. They prefer to deal with a national from that country. So we employ them. We pride ourselves on great customer service. So for the bigger countries, that's what we do. And then we'll have translators for all of the countries of Europe so that all of the, you know, all the content on the website and the emails and so forth is all written by a native speaker. But then we'll do some Google Translate for some customer service in smaller countries. Yeah. So, I mean, again, that's another pain point, you know, dealing with Europe. But again, if you get over that, you need to get over that really.
Yeah, man, I'm feeling like spoiled for operating in the United States where there's just, you know, primarily one language you have to worry about, you know, and all of this stuff. How are you doing? Because I go to the website, you know, mathmos.com, and maybe that's just, I'm going there because I'm accessing it from the US. How are you dealing with selling to different countries from a website perspective? Do you have different, I guess I'm looking at the top right now, you've got the UK website. Oh, wow. And I drop it down and I can see there's probably 20, close to 25 here, Italy, Spain, you know, Netherlands, all this kind of stuff. What are you using to run the back end of all this? Because when I select from one of your 20 different sites, completely changes. It's all custom language. It's a different, it's not just language change, it's a different URL. What are you running this on?
Well, I mean, we are replatforming now. We have Xcart, which is marvelous, ancient platform. And we have 12 different websites hosted on top level domains in different countries locally. So, you know, that's a bit of a hemorrhoid to run.
I was going to say your IT person or you or whoever's doing it is kudos to them.
Yeah, exactly. The great thing is we have great SEO and we're extremely niche. So, you know, we come up, you know, pretty well all over the place.
Oh, it's amazing. I mean, I'm looking at, you got Romania, you got Switzerland, you've got Germany, Denmark, Belgium, Austria. I mean, this is, I imagine your conversion rates for these are phenomenal despite all the complexity.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a bit of a clunky way of doing it, and we probably won't go on doing it quite like that. But yeah, it served its purpose well, and yeah, Europe's, you know, it's a pain, but it, you know, if you do the work, again, it's worth it if you do the work. And I think, you know, if you're a very, very niche brand as we are, then it works. Yeah.
What do you mentioned your replatforming? I feel like there's still not a lot of great options for people who want to do multi-site with a shopping cart and not have to manage a bunch of different installs. What are you migrating to manage all these different sites in Europe?
Yeah, well, I mean, don't laugh. I think we're going to go, having been around the houses for the last few months, I think we're going to go to WooCommerce WordPress sites. That's what we're going to do, I think.
Oh, to, you said WooCommerce?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Okay. And what made you pick, like, what did, if you wouldn't mind, what was on your short list? Like, maybe what were the top two or three options you looked at? And why did you pick WordPress for multi-site international?
Well, we looked at Shopify and Shopify Plus. We decided that the SEO wasn't great, which is, you know, one of our main things, and that it would end up being really expensive and maybe it wasn't necessary, really. We looked at BigCommerce, we discounted that. We looked at Magento, we couldn't kind of bear to go there.
I'm guessing Magento because just complexity, enterprise.
I think We don't really need it. I mean, we don't have a huge inventory. It's really about telling the story and the localization. So I think that's where we're going to go. Yeah.
What for BigCommerce, what made you pick WooCommerce over BigCommerce?
I'm trying to remember now. I think the internationalization just wasn't, you know, just wasn't really great for Europe. There wasn't a sort of cohesive way of bringing it all together. It wasn't going to make our lives any easier.
And you make everything. It's all made in England, right? You don't make any of this outside the country?
We don't make every component in the UK. You can't even buy some things in Britain, like bulbs and so forth. But yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean like absolutely everything. Like you manufacture everything and a lot of like the metalwork and lathing and stuff you do in England, right?
We do, yeah. I mean, I think that's part of it, really. You know, it's kind of extraordinary to have got 57 years of the same product made from the same place, you know, and that feels quite special. And even though it is, you know, it's quite, you know, it's hard and it's expensive. It's very much part of our brand.
Yeah, it's a huge part. Well, I imagine too, when people are talking about shipping container prices doubling and ships being queued up outside of ports waiting to get in, I'm sure there's definitely some hard parts to domestic manufacturing as well. But those probably make you, those conversations probably, you know, give you, make you smile a little bit.
Yeah, it's true. It's nice to have it close to you, and it's great to be able to actually go and visit, you know, get in the car and an hour away, you go and see your suppliers. It's great and have more control. Yeah.
Well, this has been wonderful. Thank you for kind of sharing the story, talking about wholesale and just kind of diving into your experience with selling in Europe and Brexit. I'd love to kind of wrap up if you're open to it. Just a half dozen quick little lightning round questions if you're game.
Go for it.
What's your favorite piece of e-commerce tech? Apart from Magento, of course.
Well, I'm going to be kind of dull and just point to Orderwise. When we got our German fulfillment center, we had to sort of get a seamless way of communicating with them. So we moved to an ERP software called Orderwise, and it's been amazing. And this last year, I've had, you know, the most fantastic granular data on exactly what's selling where and how. That's been really great.
Very cool. Orderwise for an ERP. Interesting. What's one of the fondest memories from your childhood?
Well, I was thinking about a sort of entrepreneurial memory. I remember every year in the summer, my mother, who's an antique dealer, she used to do stall at this country fair. And me and my brothers and sisters all used to go along. We used to always look forward to it because they had these bottles. I don't know if they had them in the States, but they had bottles. And if you took them back to the vendor, you got 10p a bottle. So we, you know, we spent the whole week collecting bottles, and it was such a thrill. You know.
That's great. That's great. There's many of these you could pick from, but what's your favorite British pastime or tradition?
I think the way in Britain, you just keep carrying on. So if you've planned to go and dress up and have a, you know, celebratory picnic in a field with your friends and it's raining, you just go and do it anyway. You know, people just continue as if nothing has changed. And I kind of like that.
Yeah. And that's the testament of the keep calm and carry on. Is that where that comes from?
I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. For your business, what's been the most effective marketing strategy for you in the last 6 to 12 months?
Well, I think actually managing the stock, making sure, you know, it's not a marketing strategy, but frankly, it was, you know, the last 6 months were very challenging on the manufacturing side. It was really about making stuff in time, getting it to the right place, the right country at the right time. So really, we haven't been focusing on marketing. We've been focusing on supplying demand. So yeah, that would be my story for 6 months.
Yeah, no, I think keeping your stock, having stuff to sell is absolutely an effective marketing strategy, especially this year. What you obviously, you know, you guys sell the original lava lamp products. What you have a lot of different kind of styles and types. What's your favorite lamp or product that you sell? And we'll link up to it.
It's got to be the Astro, which is the 1963 design by Edward Craven Walker. So that's, you know, the first lava lamp made in Britain for 57 years.
Wow. Yeah, classic. What was a major seminal moment or period in your life that really shaped who you've become?
Well, you know, with the Duke dying this week, I was thinking about going to Buckingham Palace for Queen's Awards for Export. We won a couple of those. And it's a great prize to win. You get to go meet the Queen and shake hands with the Queen. And, you know, that's a real moment of celebration for the company. And you have to go with a group of people from different parts of the business. So we went in a group and that was a great, great time.
Very cool. That sounds fantastic. And then finally, what's the most interesting, or excuse me, who's the most interesting person you've met as a part of being an ECF member? It could be somebody you've actually met in person, somebody you've exchanged some PM with. It could be just someone whose content you appreciate in the forums.
Well, I had a chat with Doug Bellchamber of topspinpro.com about wholesale. I think he's been on a similar journey to us. So yeah, I mentioned him. I've just joined. So I'm really looking forward to meeting some more people and learning a lot more. Yeah.
Hopefully be able to get some UK meetups and events going this coming year, COVID allowing. So we'll see how that goes. Well, thank you so much. And if obviously you've been listening, we've obviously been talking about the lava lamps, but mathmos.com, mathmos.com, check it out. It's again, the original lava lamp. They've kind of nurtured through the years and very, you know, a lot of different variations. You guys make massive ones for lobbies, the small rocket ship ones to the classic, the Astro, which you mentioned. So very cool website, classic product. Make sure to check it out. And thank you so much for being willing to come on and talk and share and for being a part of the community. It's been wonderful having you.
Oh, thanks so much for asking me. Really enjoyed it.
Thanks so much for listening. And the fact that you made it to the end of the episode tells me you're probably somewhat interested in this stuff and might be a really good fit for the e-commerce fuel community. Our community is the world's largest group of 7- and 8-figure e-commerce store owners and offers a value-packed forum, dynamic live events, and much more. If that sounds interesting at all, you should learn about membership and how to apply at ecommercefuel.com. Big thank you to our two sponsors. Supercharge your email marketing efforts with Klaviyo, the world's best email and SMS marketing engine at klaviyo.com/ECF. And also one-click upsell from Zipify Apps, where you can rapidly increase your average order value by offering powerful targeted upsells. You can get started with them at ecommercefuel.com/upsell. Finally, thanks to Sherelle Torrecampo for helping produce the show. Work hard, adventure often, and I'm looking forward to seeing you again next Friday.
This is the ASY Radio Network live from New York.